You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is proud to be a part of the Airwave Media family, home of such shows as Fork in the Road, Small Things Often, and Therapist Uncensored. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Karen and I were excited to talk to Chris French again. Chris has been working in the overlap between psychology and parapsychology for many years and has written extensively about his findings. Next year, he's going to be bringing out a book about his work in this area, and we caught up with him as he's about to join the road tour for the very popular BBC radio series Uncanny with Danny Robbins. So let's just hop right into that conversation.
Monster Talk.
Is the sound okay for you?
Yeah, you sound good. You sound good. Thanks for making time for us today.
When does the book come out now? You said it was moved from time to March.
Yeah, okay. It's March next year. Yeah.
Okay, well, we can talk to you again then. There's always something to talk about.
Yeah.
I would think so. Yeah.
Great.
You've been here before. As a reminder, we do these things. We record them and they'll go out later. This one will go out next week. I'll just hop in with an intro and then we'll just jump into questions. And our new format's, 30 to 40 minutes. We're trying to get out episodes every week now. So the machine must be fed.
Exactly. The ghost in the machine.
We're excited to welcome back Chris French. Chris is head of the Anomalistic Psychology Department at Goldsmiths University, London. He's a fellow of the British Psychological Society and the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry. He's published many articles and wrote the book Anomalistic Psychology, along with Anna Stone. And his latest book, which is coming out next year, is called, and I love this, The Science of Weird Shit. And has a foreword by Richard Wiseman, also a friend of the show. I find this funny because my colleague Jeb Card talks about this whole the panoply of weird paranormal things as weird shitology, and I think he means there he's studying the study of weird shit. But are you facing any pressure on the title? I've seen a lot of sort of creative ways to get around. Points instead of eyes, all sort of things. Yeah.
I kind of assumed in my head. Well, first of all, that was not what I was going to call the book. I was going to call the book Why Weird Stuff Matters, which I still think is a pretty good title. And then just jokingly, I said to a few friends, or I might just call it The Science of Weird Shit. And almost without exception, people said, oh, I'd buy that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a more sellable.
And then I thought, well, will the publisher accept that? No comeback at all on it. No, they loved it. And in fact,
Who's
in my
publisher?
Head, It's at MIT Press. So, proper grown-up publishers, yeah.
Yeah, well, I've got a book coming out next year called Bitch, about the history and use of the word. So, yeah, they're just getting more lenient with stuff like this. It's great.
That's it, yeah. In my head, it did have an asterisk for the I in final.
For me too, yeah.
But no, they insisted, no asterisk. We're just going to go for it. So,
I love it.
Well, now I'm feeling empowered to write a new book called The Big Book of Real Things, and that I any word. anyway, well, that's very exciting, though. So this is this kind of like a broad spectrum look back at the topics that you've been looking at for your career, or is it what's sort of the content here?
It's exactly that. I mean, I've been wanting to write this book for at least a couple of decades, and the day job just kept getting in the way. I retired in October 2020, and finally had the time to actually get the damn thing finished. It is all very exciting. I've kind of wanted to do a popular science book on anomalistic psychology for a long time. Writing the textbook was, you know, it had its own rewards. But having a popular science book where you can kind of have a much lighter tone, you know, you can throw in funny stories, you know, it's much more conversational, I hope, in tone. And so far, the people who've read it seem to like it. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Good deal.
Fantastic. And so, Chris, there are so many things that we could discuss with you, and we thought we'd start by talking about a little bit about the psychology of ghosts and hauntings, because you've done so many investigations and so much research into this over the course of your career. And I thought we'd begin by just asking, for humans, what needs do you think that belief in ghosts and hauntings fulfills?
I think with respect to that question, it's basically our fear of our own mortality. And maybe even more so, the idea that when our loved ones die, that's it, that's the end of them, we'll never have any contact with them again, is something that most of us find quite uncomfortable to think about, say the least. And so any kind of evidence which seems to support the idea of life after death is going to be something that we go for. I mean, we all know about confirmation bias. The evidence doesn't really have to be that good to support the idea that there is evidence for life after death. Now, although, you know, people usually think of ghosts as being kind of quite a negative, scary kind of concept. I mean, it's not for everybody, it has to be said, but it is for most people. But even having said that, it is some kind of evidence for life after death. And I think that's the basic emotional motivation behind it.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. I think there is sort of I guess maybe it's because of fiction and the way people present these stories. The stories that are spooky and scary and involve recurring events tend to be the ones that get dramatized and written up. But I know personally plenty of people who have anecdotes about, oh, I smelled something that reminded me of my mother, or I heard, you know, a bell that we used to hear, you know, at a certain time. And like, it just all these sort of like super warm memories and happy and like, and that's just our friendly ghost. I mean, there's lots of non-confrontational kinds of people just living with it, thinking that that's the explanation. So I wonder about that, because like I think skeptics, a lot of times we get caught up in the is it real, is it not real thing, and forget that these experiences, they serve a purpose. I mean, like, you know, I know lots of people who are atheists, but clearly lots of people participate in religion. They're getting something out of it, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I suppose in this context, the question of people going to see mediums. I mean, in my mind, I make a huge distinction between the deliberate con artists, the frauds who are out to exploit vulnerable people just purely in their own interests, on the one hand. But I do think that's probably the minority. I think most people who think they've got some kind of mediumistic gift genuinely and sincerely believe that they have. And that raises the whole question of when people go after a bereavement, for a reading, it's a different. It's two different questions, as you're making very clear. One question is, well, can mediums really talk to the dead? Well, I think we all know what opinion we have on that question. But the question of, well, does it do more harm than good? That has received hardly any research. And it's a shame, because I suspect that under some circumstances it may do some harm. I suspect under a lot of circumstances it doesn't. It maybe provides some temporary comfort to get people through a difficult period, and then they can stand on their own two feet and get on with their lives. So, you know, they are different questions.
Cool. And do you find in your research that there is a big distinction between these people who maybe practice mediumship from home and or read tea leaves and coffee grinds and something like that, and the very famous psychics on TV, perhaps those we shouldn't name, who, I mean, in my experience anyway, a lot of them have said off the record, oh, I'm not psychic, or I don't have any abilities, and they know that they're frauds.
Well, one of the, it varies, tongue firmly in cheek, in my book, I have French's first law and French's second law. French's second law is, the higher the profile of the psychic, the more likely it is that they're a deliberate fraud.
Right.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Most of the kind of, I mean, we've tested a number of people who claim to have psychic ability or mediumship. They don't pass the test. Surprise, surprise. But the readings are not really all that impressive, whereas I've seen cold readers in action. And even though I know they're using cold reading techniques, I can be blown away by how impressive the reading is. And that's because they're systematically exploiting the technique. They're getting every bit of juice out of it, you know?
And they're usually psychologists or magicians.
That's right. You know, they're kind of the people who kind of, you know, like I say, they've practiced the technique. They know how to get the most out of it. Whereas with your average workaday medium or psychic, they may be doing something similar without being aware of the fact they're doing it, but they're not able to exploit it to its full potential in the same way. And so now that's one situation. Even if you are one of those kind of workaday mediums or psychics, you'll probably have enough satisfied customers that will come back, because most people are so polite, certainly in this country, that they may come away and tell all their friends, that was rubbish, you know, and I'm never going back again. But as long as you've got enough people who are coming back and telling their friends that, oh, I was really impressed, it was really good. And of course, a lot of the time, people don't go for those readings with the intention of trying to figure out whether or not that the medium or the psychic can really do what they claim they can do. They go for comfort and for advice and so on.
And they believe.
And if that's what they feel they're getting, they'll go back again for more. But if you are a high-profile medium or psychic who's doing stage shows and TV programs and so on and so forth, then the temptation, you've got to deliver every night. And every time you're in front of the cameras, you can't afford to have some readings that are just where people are just totally unimpressed and say that was rubbish. And so the temptation to cheat is that much stronger.
We're thinking a lot about ghosts and hauntings this time of year. Mm-hmm. I've actually been following the British podcast/radio show Uncanny with Danny Robbins.
Yeah.
So it's definitely made it over here. I've had it recommended by numerous Americans, but I don't have a real sense of how popular it is in the UK, except that I see lots of ads for it when I go.
It's hugely popular. I mean, it's transferring, well, not transferring. It's a new series that just started on BBC Radio 4. And on top of that, they're doing a few TV specials starting, I think, mid-October.
Nice.
I mean, I'm in one of them. And then we're also going on tour. We're doing a nationwide tour. And so I'll be doing about 15 or 16 gigs up and down the country on stage with Danny and Evelyn Hollow. And it's all going to be very theatrical. Danny Robbins at the moment is just going from strength to strength. He's also got had a play in the West End that won awards and is now on Broadway and also in Australia. I mean, you know,
this may explain really why he doesn't answer our calls.
He's a very, very, very busy man. He's got a book that's just come out. Obviously, his book has come out ahead of his tour. So although I'll be trying to get a mention in any available opportunity, I won't actually have any copies to sell and sign, you know?
Yeah. Well, so for people who haven't heard it, it's an interesting show because what it does is they present ghost cases. And I'm gathering that these are often pre-recorded. And then they cut back to experts. So they have skeptics and non-skeptics, or skeptics and believers, however you want to call that. And they sort of like have a section where they talk about the phenomena. And then they say, hey, is there any sort of skeptical explanation for this? And then what is the sort of more paranormal explanation? It's an interesting twist on what I think a lot of TV people try to produce here, which is the let's have one skeptic and one believer go out and investigate a case. But that's not this is more about the person's experience and then a little bit of commentary from experts on either aisle side, I think.
I think the format works very well, and I think Danny is a very good storyteller. You've probably noticed of the ones you've listened to that he kind of ramps it up as he goes along.
Bloody hell, Ken.
But if you think that was scary, just wait till you hear
exactly,
what happened next.
Exactly, yes.
You know, and that kind of stuff. So he's very, very good at doing that. And I think one thing that I think is quite nice about the program is that the experts, such as we are, kind of do tend to treat each other with respect.
Yes.
It doesn't ever deteriorate into a shouting match.
Yes.
But again, even our bits obviously are pre-recorded, and so they can be edited and so on. And I do think that the skeptics are on a bit of a sticky wicket here, insofar as obviously you're dealing with anecdotal evidence. And so inevitably you kind of find yourself going back to the same old themes of the unreliability of eyewitness testimony and, oh, well, that sounds like sleep paralysis and so on and so forth. But yeah, the thing is, that's true. You can't actually, you know, you can't obviously ever give a definitive explanation for what happened in the past when you weren't there and nobody was recording anything objectively. It's impossible. So it's quite fun, though, to do. I do enjoy taking part. And I'm quite looking forward to the tour. That should be quite exciting.
Yeah, lots of fun. And if we can continue on that point with what you're talking about, being the talking head, being the token skeptic in a sense, we wanted to talk with you about you have had this career of being a media skeptic, appearing on television and podcasts and radio for a long time as the media skeptic. Can we talk a bit about the pros and cons of this, of you doing this over the years?
Yeah. I am very aware of the kind of inherent problem in doing this, insofar as there are lots of skeptics who would say you're giving kind of too much legitimacy to the whole enterprise, you know, by taking part. You are saying this is something that should be taken seriously. I mean, as it happens, I think it is something that should be taken seriously.
But it's
part of human experience, you know, so I do genuinely, you know, obviously that's what the book's about. But it is that whole question of weighing up. I mean, I know I've taken part in some truly dreadful TV programs, but even there, there's a kind of decision to be made as to, well, you know, one, if I don't do it, somebody else will. Two, it's probably going to be quite fun. Three, I've probably got some things to say that maybe, you know, somebody who's not been doing it as long as me wouldn't think of. So, you know, I've got a kind of wider perspective, so maybe a bit more expertise.
From the skeptical side of things, you know, we're looking at fundamental questions of human perception and memory, and largely coming back with conclusions that suggest we're not all that good at perceiving things or remembering them. And that's nobody wants to be told that sad news, you know.
I see where you're coming from on that one. But I mean, I think most skeptics, certainly those that are interested in psychology, kind of feel that it's actually on balance a good thing to be aware of the fact that we all have these biases. Mm. You know, it's not just the believers that fall for confirmation bias or for any of these other cognitive biases. We've all got them. But knowing about them means you can at least try your best to stop them from influencing you too much. Now, you won't succeed because we're all human, and you know that's the way that's what it means to be human, is to be biased. But having said that, I think you are in a better position. And also, I mean, for me, you know, I'm interested in all kinds of weird shit, and that includes things like the kind of unfounded conspiracy theories that do the rounds and so on and so forth. And some of those things are obviously just, you know, very, very dangerous and very, very damaging. And part of, you know, again, it's always been the case for me that anomalistic psychology was also a really useful vehicle for teaching critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the advantage of critical thinking skills generalizes beyond just the weird stuff.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
True.
Yeah. And so, Chris, with all this exposure that you've had as a media skeptic, do you find that it helps with outreach? And do you get members of the public contacting you and emailing you, reaching out and talking to you about things or wanting your giving feedback, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that does happen. I mean, and I can't always find the time to reply to every email I get because I get too many. I mean, there are some that I feel I can be more helpful on than others. I'm not a clinical psychologist, for example. But if someone writes to me and describes an experience that I think that sounds like a classic case of sleep paralysis, I can reassure them. I can send them some literature on that. And hopefully they'll realize that, you know, it's not a ghost, it's not a demon, it's this thing called sleep paralysis that we do know about. It's scientifically and medically recognized, and hopefully that will help to calm them down. Sure. But I get sent emails from people claiming to have psychic abilities. There's a couple of chapters in the book on kind of we have tested a lot of these kind of claims over the years. But I have to confess that from my point of view, it's usually a situation where I'm thinking, really? It takes an awful lot of effort to set up an appropriately controlled test, even for a very simple claim. And I'm almost certain in advance, obviously, that you're not going to be able to demonstrate your claim under properly controlled conditions. It's a kind of mixed blessing in a way. I mean, I like to kind of, I'm more interested in kind of getting the message out there through going and doing public talks. I enjoy doing that, doing things like podcasts with you guys, the book, obviously. When it comes to kind of testing individual claims, that is something that is probably on balance not the best use of my time, is my feeling.
Why do you think so many seemingly paranormal concepts sort of evaporate into a puff of statistics when you test them under lab conditions?
Could it possibly be that paranormal forces don't exist? Just a suggestion.
Never.
I think it's worth giving that some thought. What's interesting, I mean, what you do get from taking part in those kind of things, And all the other stuff we're talking about, the kind of media stuff and so on, is it does give you kind of think some useful insights into, if you like, the lay psychology. You know, it's one thing to do, you know, what we spent a lot of our times doing, which was testing particular, on the one hand, paranormal claims under properly well-controlled conditions, And on the other hand, sometimes testing our non-paranormal explanations, you know, can we find evidence that people really are as susceptible to the power of suggestion as we would claim that they were? I mean, again, just to expand on that a little bit, I think it's very easy for skeptics sometimes to come up with very plausible counter-explanations for a paranormal claim. I think it's much more convincing if you can actually produce some evidence for your explanation for what's going on, you know, rather than just, oh, well, it was probably the power of suggestion. You know, we do studies where we show the power of suggestion. We show how memory can be distorted and so on and so forth, you know. So and that for me kind of adds strength to our side of the argument. I've forgotten what the original question was now, I'm afraid.
Oh, it was just, why do so many paranormal concepts evaporate into statistics?
Oh, yeah. Statistics. I think just that basically, you know, my view is that there was nothing there to kind of find in the first place. But it is often interesting. I mean, you know, we bend over backwards. I was at the QED conference a couple of weeks back in Manchester, and I did two workshops on testing paranormal claims. And as I said there, we bend over backwards to design a test with the person who's making the claim. You know, it's got to be a fair test. It's got to be something that they say, yes, this is a fair test of my claim in advance. We get them to sign something to that effect. And then, of course, they fail the test and then decide in retrospect it wasn't a fair test after all. But that's the way the cookie crumbles, you know. But we do really go out of our way to try and make the test as fair as possible.
Well, I ask because you recently wrote an article, and I think this is nuanced, that had the somewhat provocative premise that parapsychology is not pseudoscience. can we talk about that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, when I first discovered the joys of skepticism, and that would be back in the early 80s, having read James Alcock's Parapsychology, Science or Magic. And it was really exciting. It was great. I loved reading all this. I've never heard of these people. James Randi, Ray Hyman, and, you know, all these other people. It was fantastic. So I was reading all that stuff. And very much, I know it's still the majority view from skeptics today, it was parapsychology is a pseudoscience. I mean, there's a huge, you know, huge discussions about the nature of pseudoscience and how you distinguish real science from pseudoscience. I really enjoyed the fact that it went beyond just the paranormal stuff. So you're talking about N-rays and polywater and homeopathy and all this other stuff. It was fabulous. But the more I actually interacted with parapsychologists, I actually realized that they weren't all incompetent. You know, I mean, there are some kind of, again, I talk about this in the book, but I mean, one of the kind of people who had quite a big influence on me was Bob Morris, you know, the late Bob Morris, cursed the chair of parapsychology. Really great, really lovely man. And I kind of realized that he welcomed skeptics to come in and look at the setup that they had in their lab up in Edinburgh, to make kind of, you know, if you saw any loopholes, tell us what they are and we'll try and tighten them and so on and so forth. And they put as much effort into, if you like, kind of the looking at what looks like it's psychic but isn't, as they did into trying to produce evidence to see whether telepathy was real or not. And he was very well informed on all the skeptics' arguments and so on. I mean, he's just one example, but I realized that actually the criticisms that the things that people used to list or still do list in those kind of, you know, here's my set of criteria for distinguishing whether something is a pseudoscience or not, empirically, a lot of them didn't actually stand up. And there were a couple of papers that I read where someone had gone to the trouble of actually kind of looking at articles, published articles in journals, and kind of trying to rate them in terms of these various criteria. And it turned out parapsychology really didn't score perfectly on all of the criteria for a real science. But then again, neither does psychology, neither do a lot of other areas of science, you know. And overall, I just decided it was probably unfair to call parapsychology a pseudoscience if those are the criteria that we were using.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And another point that I make this in the article that you're referring to is that you know, when people like myself and Richard Wiseman and Sue Blackmore and James Randi are actually testing paranormal claims, it would be hard to argue that we're not doing parapsychology. And hopefully we're doing
it
scientifically and with proper controls. In which case, the basic argument is that at its best, parapsychology is just as scientific, certainly as psychology.
Fascinating. I've certainly heard Joe Nichols describe himself as a cryptozoologist, you know, for the same reasons, right?
Talk.
I mean, at the end of the day, science is a method. You know, it's not an established body of facts. And you can approach, I mean, again, you do end up, for me, in this kind of weird situation of thinking that you can have a genuine science about something that doesn't exist, you know, because I'm not convinced that paranormal forces exist. But I still think you can approach that question scientifically. And that's therefore, for me, makes parapsychology a legitimate science.
Well, and it does open up that other, I think, equally interesting question, which is if it doesn't exist, why is it so important and so believed by so many people? You know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like it again, it's like I think that's where I'm really coming down after all these years. It's like whatever this is that we're doing, I think we're trying to better understand humans, and humans do a lot of weird stuff.
Sure, they just
weird shit.
I mean, the other thing for me as somebody who's kind of very interested in both the strengths and the weaknesses of the scientific method.
Also true.
I mean, and this particularly is something that I gave a lot of thought to. You remember a few years back, Daryl Bem published a paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm sure you do. Got a huge amount of attention, obviously, as it would. Myself and Richard Wiseman and Stuart Ritchie each attempted to do an independent replication, which we knew from the we expected from the off would not replicate. Our ulterior motive was to try and find a quick way of getting a paper into a top psychology journal. That didn't work out because the editor rejected it on the basis that we don't publish replications. And then we got the same treatment from a couple of other high impact journals. And then this became a story in itself because it revealed a huge bias in scientific publishing, that it's not about it. It's basically about publishing new findings and positive findings and not failed replications.
But they're really important. But they're really
exactly
important.
Exactly. Yeah. Because that's distorting what's actually happening on the ground, you know? And that also then fed into the what was called the replication crisis in psychology, where we realized it's not just, I mean, parapsychology has replication issues that I think are worse than any other area, but some of the things that were being had been published even in standard textbooks for years in psychology, people began to say, well, we don't think this stuff replicates. We don't think it's a real effect. And that raised the whole question, well, why, you know, how did these effects arise in the first place? That it led to a period of healthy self-criticism within the discipline. Mm-hmm. And we all became much more aware of what are called questionable research practices. And now this is not out-and-out fraud. It's not making your data up. But it's just there are so many decision points in designing and running and analyzing your data from your experiments where you can give yourself the benefit of the doubt. And it doesn't feel like you're doing a kind of, you know, major crime at the time, but all these things can be cumulative and lead to a situation where you end up with a lot of spuriously significant results being published in the literature.
Absolutely.
And I can look back now on the stuff that I've published in mainstream psychology, and some of those effects I'm pretty damn sure were not genuine effects now, but I mean, I published them in good faith at the time, you know.
Sure,
And that's kind of, that's been interesting because it raises that whole, you know, I've said this before, you know, all science is about trying to sort the signal from the noise. What would a science look like if it was just noise? And I think it would look like parapsychology.
Nicely said. Yeah, it's very, very eye-opening. But Chris, we want to have you back on the show next year, a little closer to the time of the release of your book. But in the meantime, we've had you on the show before and we have talked about your favorite monster, so we thought we'd shake things up a little bit, ask you a slightly different question. Could you tell us about your favorite case?
My favorite case? Now, does this mean one that I've been directly involved in myself?
Anything. It is your call. Your call.
Okay. All right. Well, if we're going to do favorite case kind of from the general literature, I think I would probably go for the Rendlesham UFO case.
Really?
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think it's a damn sight better than Roswell. Sorry, guys, you know, but it is.
That's okay.
You know, you've got a situation there where you had kind of an official memorandum from an American Air Force, USAF officer saying, you know, basically, yes, a UFO's landed, essentially, you know. So that's pretty good. And there's also, I mean, again, one of the things about that case and a lot of my other favourite cases is that I think a lot of the classic cases, whether we're talking about UFOs, ghosts, cryptids or whatever, are those cases where you just happen to have coincidentally a number of different things happening at about the same time. And so, you know, any one kind of simple explanation doesn't work, so that the believers can say, oh, yes, but you've not accounted for this.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think, and the Rendlesham case is just fantastic in that respect. You know, there were several things that just happened to happen around the same time, you know. So I'll probably go for that one. In terms of, I mean, I've not actually, most of the kind of investigations I've been involved in have been as part of TV programs, and I guess that the best one there, the one that certainly, you know, is most memorable in my mind, back in the last century, towards the end of the last century, I took part in a program about reincarnation claims amongst the Druze, and got to spend about 3 weeks in Lebanon. It was the only time in my life I've ever stayed in a five-star hotel, so that was memorable in itself.
Oh, yeah, that is, yes.
Yeah, but it was a really, really, really interesting experience. You know, they had quite a big budget for the filming, so and we because a lot of the background research had already been done for us, things were set up, we already had interviews set up, kind of so on and so forth. But that was, and it was quite an eye-opener, just in terms of I felt I really learned something from doing that. I mean, I went out there not knowing quite what to expect, but with a strong suspicion that a lot of these past life memories that particularly children came up with amongst the Druze society may well be false memories. And I came back pretty much convinced that that's what was happening.
Yeah.
But it was just a brilliant experience.
Wow.
Sounds like it. Yeah, cool.
Well, thank you so much for coming back to talk to us again.
My pleasure. It's been lovely talking to you guys.
And we'll put links in the show notes for people to catch up with the Uncanny Tour.
Good luck with that too.
Yeah, for sure. You? And then there's obviously you've been on some previous episodes, so they can check the back catalog there. And maybe someday Danny will have time for us. We'll see.
I'll put in a good word.
Would love to chat with him about the show.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and we'll bid you adieu.
Okay.
We'll keep in touch too for next year.
Absolutely.
Please do.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard a conversation with Professor Chris French, whose upcoming book on his career of scientific investigation into paranormal topics is titled The Science of Weird Shit. We'll try and have him back for more discussion in 2024 when his book's closer to hitting the shelves. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you for listening, and if you've been enjoying what we've been making, please leave us a positive review or tell someone about what we do here. People will listen to you when you tell them to listen to us, and we appreciate that so very much.
Been a Monster House presentation.